Welcome to the Unscripted SEO Interview Podcast. Yes, it's 100% unscripted, 100% unrehearsed, 100% unedited, and 100% real. I'm your host, Mark A. Preston. Today, we have Sam Partland with us. Well, I can describe Sam best as he's been traveling the world for the past few years and as an SEO nomad. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
Okay. So for those people in the audience watching this who doesn't know who you are, could you give an overview of who Sam is, who Sam the SEO is, and why you're traveling the world?
Yeah, I can do that. Sam, I've been doing SEO for about 16 or 17 years now. I discovered in high school that you can make money online. And so I thought I'd give it a crack and see what I could do. Quickly fell into SEO after realizing I didn't have to pay for traffic. And back in those days, it was a bit shadier with what you could do, and you could rank websites a bit faster. So I got dug into SEO pretty quickly doing that. I'm from Adelaide in Australia. I left Adelaide in about 2013, moved to Sydney, moved to Melbourne for another job, moved back to Sydney, moved back to Melbourne, and then I moved to Chiang Mai in Thailand for a few months and really kicked off my nomad journey. I used to work for myself back in Adelaide for a couple of years. I lasted, and then I was really bad with finances, and that kind of fell through, and thus I needed to pick up an SEO job in Sydney. But then for the next few years, I really wanted to get back working for myself. And I saw an opportunity pop up while I was down in Melbourne. An amazing job. I just wasn't loving working for kind of someone else as much anymore. And so I took the leap again and jumped back into working for myself and moved somewhere where there were other people around, I guess, that also did SEO, but also that it was a lot cheaper to live. And so I didn't need to make as much money to be able to live a good life.
So the SEO nomad life, do you think it's for people who are freelance, who are doing their own thing?
So that's what I used to think. I used to definitely think that, I mean, I still think that contractors and freelancers are always suited to the nomad work because you're not stuck to a set amount of hours. What you'll quickly realize when being a nomad is you got to catch a flight sometimes. And those flights, you want to get the cheap flights. Everyone wants to get the cheap flights. And those flights are going to be at 6 a.m. and then through the day. It's going to be rare that you're going to find a nice cheap overnight flight because everyone wants to catch those ones. But what I've since realized, though, being in South America, is there's a lot of, particularly Americans, but a lot of people here with a normal job now, post-COVID. There's people here that their workplaces think they're back in their home country or their home state, and they're down here living life at a third or a quarter of the price of what they would be back home. And they're doing the 9-to-5. And so the 9-to-5 in America, in the US from here, would be, I think it's about a 10-to-6 hour job. But then I've met Europeans that are working their 9-to-5 out here that are working super late hours where they're getting up at, say, 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. to be able to match the time zone. And so it, before COVID, it used to be a lot more freelancers, a lot more contractors that I was meeting. But now it seems to be a bit more standard to have a 9-to-5 and be able to work from wherever you want.
So because you're talking to these other SEO people on a regular basis, do you think the fact that COVID has highlighted the remote working opportunities and the companies and agencies are more open to, well, as long as you do your work, I don't care where you work from?
I think this is moving that way. Agency work still is a lot more, from what I've understood, a lot more they want to kind of see you face-to-face somewhat. But it is definitely feels like it's moving the way where as long as you're getting your work done, you can kind of do it wherever you want to be. I mean, I haven't worked for agency side for 7 or 8 years now, so it's been a little while. But, I mean, after speaking with people working agency side, that it does feel like they're getting a lot more freedom with when and where they can work. And particularly, it seems like a lot more agencies, particularly in the UK, moving towards the whole four-day work week, giving people a lot more freedom in that regard.
Yeah, I noticed the four-day work week has been highlighted once or twice by some companies and agencies. So for someone that's thinking about the nomad life and they do have a full-time job, what do they have to think about regarding work visas when they're traveling the world?
So digital nomading is still a shady area, and it will be a shady area for a number of years still. There's a few countries that are opening up. So basically, I come in as a tourist. As far as the majority of the countries that I go to are aware, I am a tourist. I pay taxes in Australia. I'm not working for Argentinian businesses. I'm not working for the businesses in the country I am. So I'm not taking work away from someone. So in terms of the shady, it's like, yes, I'm doing work, but I'm not doing anything that's going to impact the local businesses and taking work away. To officially set up, that's the concern that a lot of countries have, that someone like me comes in and that I'm going to take away work from local businesses here. So with regards to work visas, the majority of people will be doing it on that grey area where it's not illegal, but it's not a signed contract or something. There's no official way of being allowed to work. But then, yeah, there's countries coming in now with nomad visas. So you could go to a place like Brazil and get one of these new nomad visas that are coming through, and then you pay a percent of your income to the Brazilian government, like tax. And then you could become, that's where you basically pay your money, pay tax.
So basically you tax twice, one from your own country and one from the country you're in.
That's how it would work initially. Yeah, unfortunately. And for the US, I think it is, no matter where you are, you'll always pay your US tax as well. So,
yeah. Great. Now, I've noticed you sharing a few things regarding programmatic, is it? SEO.
Yeah.
What is it?
So the easiest way to describe programmatic SEO is that you take data and you create web pages. That's in a simplest form. But it's any web portal, any directory, any classified website is doing programmatic SEO. They have a set of data, being their listings. Let's go with real estate. They have real estate listings. Now, taking those real estate listings and creating an SEO-optimized search experience, that's what programmatic SEO is. You're not saying, I want page by page by page like you do in WordPress. You're saying you want a page for every property type, being apartments, but then you want a page for every location, and you want a combo page for every property type and location. And then the system will automatically essentially create these pages, even though they're technically not being created. So it's taking the data and it's spinning up a page where as soon as Google finds a link, a page is essentially there as far as Google knows.
Yeah. So basically you are structuring the main template pages. Then the data populates the individual pages.
Exactly. You create a template around by what the page will be create, what will create the page, and then the system does the rest.
Right. So how is that different to normal SEO? How the whole emphasis on programmatic SEO, isn't it just what SEO should do anyway?
Yes, essentially. So the main difference I see between normal SEO and programmatic SEO is the thought process. You're not optimizing page by page. You can't go in and tell a developer or ask a developer that you need this real estate in Melbourne with properties under $500,000 page to have this title and the rest of the system to have this other title. You need to think about it in a different way, where every optimization you make could affect 1,000 pages, it could affect 100,000 pages, it could affect 1 million pages. You're not doing it one by one, you're doing it on the scale. So you need to be able to make sacrifices. You need to be able to optimize for the 80% of the value, essentially, because there's always going to be outliers that you can't immediately optimize for. But at the start, you target 80%. And then you try and add another rule to target 80% of that 20%. And you kind of, as you go, you can slowly refine your optimizations. But yeah, it's just more so how you think about it and how you attack it.
So is it kind of SEOing down the sales funnel?
Kind of, yeah.
I'm trying to think of a way to relate it to something every day. So, you know, just a scenario.
Well, I guess instead of optimizing an article, you optimize one page using variables. So instead of saying this programmatic SEO project I'm blogging about at the moment, can dogs eat bananas? You're not optimizing for can dogs eat bananas. You're optimizing for can animal eat food. And then animal and the food get swapped out.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically you're just putting the variables in.
Yes,
exactly. Yeah, for the page. Yeah, I've seen this in action from a project someone I know has been doing, and they're driving a ton of traffic. They really are.
It's definitely coming in. I wouldn't say you're coming into fashion, but there's a lot more people doing it now because there's systems that are making it easier. You got CMSs like Webflow popping up that are just making programmatic SEO a lot simpler. You've then got platforms like Next.js and more advanced React platforms that are making this easier for people to build proper SEO optimized systems and that are server side. Whereas these sorts of systems used to be client side, Google couldn't crawl them, they didn't rank as well, etc.
Good. So yourself as an SEO, what do you personally specialize in?
So my main specialty is with real estate portals and classified directories and similar sized businesses where they've got some sort of product and then they've got a search experience. So I can come in and optimize the search experience. I used to work for a company called Airtasker in Australia. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they've now expanded it to UK, US, etc. And one of the things that I was hired for was to build a new landing page generation system for them. And so it's called a self-scaling landing page system where as new tasks were posted on the platform, we could categorize the tasks up, put them on an appropriate landing page, and then you'd have a targeted landing page for, say, plumbers in Melbourne, spin up. And so my specialty around these sorts of businesses was to be able to help them come up with a strategy to be able to take their existing content, build these landing pages, and then have it hands-free. So this Airtasker system we built 4 or 5 years ago now has just constantly been creating new pages as the business has been growing, allowing them to target new keywords every single day, as long as they get enough tasks in that location posted.
What happens about content then?
Well, that's the system with the programmatic. So at a core level, you use the tasks as the content, or you use the listings as the content. So think about if you're looking for real estate in Sydney, you go to a page about real estate in Sydney, you're not going to see a 1,000-word article about real estate in Sydney. You're going to see 20 to 30 properties in Sydney that are for sale that then link through to that listing page. So the core of that search experience is just reusing those 20 to 30 listings on a search page. And then you can add some frequently asked questions now and a little snippet about the content and really dynamically create the text. But then you can go one step extra, which is what they're doing with Airtasker now. And they are adding that extra 500 words of unique content to the page to kind of add an extra content type. And it's kind of you scale your system, you build it up as you go. You first get your core product, which is using those that content live on your landing pages or your search page, and then you upgrade it as time goes on and see what else you can kind of add to it.
It all makes sense. Now, when you are traveling the world and talking to other SEOs out there, do you ever discuss how SEOs different in each country? Whether it's more advanced or not as advanced. So say, for instance, like Australia and the UK, is it very different or is it forward of the time? Is it up to date? What's the variant?
So from what I've seen, it's not so much the country for it, it's the language. So English is a lot more advanced than a few of the other languages because certain people creating these bulk systems, and that can only target English because that's what they speak. It's easiest for them to push out. But there is a big, and the last few years, there's a big opportunity within non-English speaking markets. And so with regards to Spanish and Argentina, where I am now, there is an opportunity there where it's not so much not advanced, there's not as many competitors. There's not as many people doing it because you've got an English speaker in Australia. They're not just targeting Australia because it's a small market. They're going after the UK, but they're also going after the US. So the US is one of the more competitive markets, not just because of the US SEOs, but because of every other SEO around the world trying to target that US market. Whereas somewhere like Argentina, speaking Spanish, you don't have all those SEOs from the rest of the world trying to target Argentina. So it's even though the population's decent size, it's just the people targeting that specific market and language.
I'm going to say, do you speak any other languages?
I mean, I can say hello in Spanish and Thai and Vietnamese and order a coffee. I think that's about it.
Right. So it's not essential then, but more helpful to get by working in these countries?
I mean, most of the places I'll go tend to have a basic English, like the co-working, the hotels. I can get by. There is a lot of Google Translate you can use, so Google Translate is definitely a shortcut. But, no, you can definitely get by. They obviously appreciate you speaking a little bit more when possible, and I can string together a few sentences here and there should I need, but most of the time I'll just whip Google Translate out to do what I want and just kind of wait a minute type thing.
Right. So I did want to get more into the basically working your way around the world as an SEO. Now, yeah. Remote working is starting to become more common. So I want to hear about stories, the good, bad and in between stories of for anyone actually thinking about doing it.
Okay, so the biggest thing you'll encounter for someone wanting to kick off is internet. It can range, it can be so varied from just a couple megabits to having 400 or 500 megabits. Like where I am now is about 450 megabit a second speed. Whereas I've been in hotels, I've been in co-works where you can be sub of 1 megabit speed and you just can't even load Facebook sometimes. You can't load a basic Google search. And so that's the biggest concern and the biggest thing I advise people to kind of look into before they go somewhere in the middle of nowhere because it's off the beaten path. If it's off the beaten path, you probably don't have internet as well. So I tend to stick to the main tourist places just because of that. I know infrastructure-wise that if somewhere I go doesn't have good internet, I can just go next door and they might have good internet. So that would be my biggest pointer around that.
Well, I'm going to say because obviously if somebody's working then as an SEO, they're probably going to need internet.
Exactly.
You know, so I'm going to say, do you like pick a place then say, well, I'm going to stop here 3 months so I'll find an apartment for 3 months or something like that? Or do you find it best doing, you know, do you have to plan every little detail in advance?
So some people I've met really like to plan it out. But being in Asia before COVID, I didn't really plan too much at all. I'd book a hotel for 2 nights. And if that hotel had good internet, I'd extend it. There was one hotel I was at for about 2 or 3 months just for it. And that worked out well internet-wise. But, I mean, I'd kind of plan off the reviews. I'd just do short-term planning there just so I could move. Like if I had to move straight away, I wasn't losing much. That was easy enough. But then coming to South America, the hotels weren't quite as cost-effective as what getting an Airbnb or so for a month would be. And so I was planning a little bit more out, but it just, you end up paying a bit more. You can definitely do it short notice. You just pay more. And so I've ended up paying more because I'm still not really planning too much more than a month in advance. And even when booking an Airbnb, I might only book it for 2 weeks and then extend. So I'm not the best pre-planner. But yeah, it really depends where you go and who you meet and what you know is there. So in South America, there's a chain, and now they're opening up in Asia and a few other places, but there's a chain called Selena. Now, Selena let you do a deal called co-live, and you pay for the month, and you can either stay in a dorm, a small room with shared bathrooms, or a private room or a suite, and you pay differently for the month depending on where you are. So for $300 US, I think it's $350 US, you can stay and work for a month in a Selena location but stay in a dorm. I'm a little bit, let's say, older for the dorms now, so I did a private room, which was $1,100 US for the month. But you get a standard room, private bathroom, like a proper hotel room. And then you also get access to a co-working. And so the co-working, I'd say above 15, 20 megabit in most cases. But I'm in a Selena co-work now, and like I said, that's 300-400 megabit. But you get accommodation, you get the co-work, you can meet people. You don't really have to plan. Like if you're on the co-live deal, you could give 2 days notice and say you want to go to a different country, and they'll move your booking there. And so they've got locations in Argentina, Brazil, Peru, heaps of different, like there's 20 or 30 of them in South America. So you can really move around with them, but you're just limited to where you can go because they're only obviously in the main spots.
I'm going to say that's really good. It's I suppose it's like the national co-working spaces with accommodation.
Exactly. It's a good start deal. You know what you're kind of getting in most of them. So it's a good way to get into the nomad.
Yeah. So regarding the client side, do the clients even know you're working your way around the world or where you are, or does it really matter for them?
Yeah, they definitely know. Like I tell them, because I can't do like early afternoon calls Australia time, because that's 2 a.m. here, 3 a.m. here. So I kind of schedule things around that. But I am lucky with regard that I mostly do project work. And so in terms of client calls, I've got two retainer clients, and I only actually have one call with them. I only have a call with one of them every month. So once a month. And he'll do that call at 8 a.m., 9 a.m. Australia time for me. So it's only 8 p.m., 9 p.m. here. So I'm pretty lucky in that regard. Though I guess I've been doing it long enough that they're kind of willing to make a bit of sacrifice for me as well, so that we can make it work.
Do you find any sort of clients or potential clients you've spoke to just think, that's not a proper job? That's like just saying, oh, I'm so against that. You can't possibly be sat there working as normal.
I do feel that way sometimes with some calls I've had. So when I was in Australia, I had a camper van during COVID. I bought a camper van, redid the whole layout and travelled up the east coast of the country. And it took me about just over a year to get from Adelaide to Cairns, so the whole east coast. And I was on a few calls and I was sitting in the van. I'd have a window behind me and there'd be normally no cover on it, and so you could see what was behind me, and that could change from being lakes and rivers to being the ocean sometimes to being fields. I was on a client call and a cow walked past once, which was pretty amusing. And so there was one client where I'd start putting the cover up because I didn't want to make them too jealous, a UK client. And they even asked me not to say where I was. They knew I was in a van somewhere, but in the middle of the UK winter, and it's 30 something degrees in Australia with the sun out, decided that it was best to kind of not mention or show where I was anymore.
Yeah, I can relate to that. But I suppose it doesn't really matter, does it? As long as the work's being done efficiently and the impact and the output is what's been promised.
Exactly. It all, the way I see it, it all comes down to the deliverable and making sure you're on top of it. There are people that will go off and party and all that and might not reach that. But that's, I guess it's a life lesson sometimes where they might lose the job or that client work or something. But I'll always make sure that the deliverable is as up to scratch as what I can make it, and that it's as on time as I can get it. And so I will, I like to say I always do good work. Things sometimes slip through, I guess, but I'll always deliver the best I can, no matter how sunny or how nice the lake outside looks.
Great. So do you think that anyone thinking of doing this and they've got the full-time job and think, well, I want to pack the full-time job in to work my way around the world as an SEO, yeah? It's not as easy as that, is it? Just to literally make a decision then day after. What is the steps? So basically you sat in the office, full-time job and everything. What do you have to prepare in order to have this life of moving around from place to place, working?
So the biggest thing that I've understood from people working their full-time jobs at the moment is the time zone. That's going to be the biggest thing. So understand, locking yourself into a location based on time zone to ensure you've got as much crossover as your work's going to require. Some people with the full-time jobs have been able to get away with only 2 hours or so a day of crossover. Others need the full 8-9 hours of crossover. So that really limits the initial planning of where you can go. But then next is making sure you've got all the gear, I guess. So one of the challenges, Argentina now is freezing. It's at the moment getting down to 3-4 degrees. So it's not exactly the warmest place, but I'm not equipped for cold weather. So I've got like this super thin thing, and then I've got a raincoat. And so I wear 3 or 4 different layers to kind of create a warm layer. So I guess just making sure that you've got the right gear to be able to go from hot to cold if you need. But then for me, it's just my tech gear. Like I've got a laptop bag that I travel with, and then a 40-litre bag that I can basically use as carry-on. And that's everything I essentially own. It is fulfilling to do though.
So as far as tech is concerned, like when you're in the office, you have all this, well, some people do, have all the latest, you know, tech and everything. As an SEO, as long as you got a laptop and internet, is that basically it?
Pretty much. So I've got my laptop, I've got my laptop stand, I've got my gaming mouse. That's a minimum requirement for me. And then it's really the headphones. On top of that, I've obviously got other bits and bobs, but I don't even have a keyboard. I just put the laptop on my laptop stand and use it like that. Other people will have the keyboard. There's also these lightweight, they're 13 to 15 inch screens that you can get that you can attach to your current screen. There's a lot of people I see using them. I tried using a tablet as a second screen. It was just easier to use my laptop. And some things take a little bit longer, which is a bit annoying. Like data and playing in Excel and that, you can't have the two sheets side to side. But you get used to it, and it's one of the sacrifices you make. It's good. It's worth it.
Right. Do you keep abreast on the news in the SEO industry while you're traveling around?
Somewhat. I've normally, most of that stuff I find is a bit fluffy. There isn't too much there other than algorithm updates and that, but chatting to mates and Twitter now and some of the main news sites, I can kind of pick up what's worth knowing about versus what's just Google changing a design that really doesn't mean too much. It's just things I've been doing for the last 10, 15 years anyway. There isn't too much that changes there because it's all on the laptop. So as long as the laptop has the internet, it's all easy enough to keep on top of.
So when you say most of it's fluff, as they say, how does someone, say, new to the industry coming in, determine what is fluff and what they should be reading?
It's definitely hard. And so I'd advise just read everything. Every single piece of fluff or not fluff, read it. As time goes on, you pick up what is the fluff and what's not the fluff, what's worth knowing and what's not worth knowing. You'll see things being repeated over and over. And so over time, everything goes through the cycle and you kind of start seeing the same things that popped up years ago that are popping up now again. And it's all becoming new news, even though you've known it. Like one of the big things at the moment was blog change where they've moved from a subdomain to a subfolder. And they're like, look at this. The subfolder is growing compared to being on the subdomain with absolutely no changes. And it's things like this that you kind of know, but this was big 2 or 3 years ago. And I think it was big again a couple of years before that, but it's kind of pick up traction again because someone's come up and said, hey, look at this. And so it's kind of going through the cycle again, but this is something that you should always be doing for the last 10 years or so. It's subfolder, better than subdomain. You get the arm and ahs, but then now and then a story like this will pop up and it's like, yeah, subfolder. But then this will kind of be hidden again. It'll go through another couple of years cycle and then someone will come out again and say, yeah, subfolder.
So, yeah, I mean, every few years, the industry has brand new audience who hasn't heard this before. Whereas myself, who's been in the industry probably forever, 22 years, like looks at it and think, oh, this is old, this is new. But then you just don't think about, well, what about all these new people coming into the industry that doesn't know this? So if we don't regurgitate the discussion again, they don't know about it, I suppose.
Oh, no, most definitely. I'm not saying that it's by no means not useful information. It's just not as useful information to me in particular. And so there's always people that will find this sort of stuff valuable. Like I've been going through my own little blogging spree over the last month or so where I gave myself a little 30-day challenge to write something every day for 30 days and ended up doing something like 45,000 words of my word vomit essentially in posts. And a lot of that to me is just basic stuff. But there's a lot of people messaging me about some of the things that I thought were super basic that they'd never heard of before and that they feel are really advanced. And so it is great to still have that information. I guess you just got the different audiences for it.
So as an SEO, how important is it to understand code or know how to code?
I think basic HTML and that sort of stuff is required somewhat just to be able to look at the source of a page and be able to understand what's going on somewhat. But for me, more so than actual code is knowing how to Google. Like when it clicked with developers, mostly don't write their own stuff. They go to Stack Overflow and they go to Google and they just exactly what they want to do. They Google it. They work out what other people are doing to solve it. And they grab it. There's millions of GitHub repos and repositories that have other people's code that you can kind of reuse. And so being able to understand how to Google something super specifically of exactly what you're after in maybe even 10 words, someone else has probably done it. And so that is more beneficial than understanding how to code, being able to find out how other people are doing something. It's more valuable, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I pause then because it isn't that the same sort of scenario as long tail searching? Shouldn't SEOs understand how people search as well as the words they use? Isn't that an important factor, or is it just me that's like, thinking, isn't this obvious? Or
no, 100%. It is one of the best skills you can have even in life now, just knowing how to Google. And it's not just being able to type a few words in, it's knowing how to be specific. And so I have met, though, many SEOs now, particularly since it's COVID, there's a lot of new people coming into the industry because they're realizing that that's how they can get their normal business on. It's how they can find a new job, how they can move around, etc. But they're still not understanding how specific you can be in a Google search. And so it is a bit of a mindset change for some people. But yeah, it's definitely an important skill and definitely one that should be learned.
So regarding being so specific in searching, do you have sort of an example that somebody can relate to?
So Google formulas, Google Sheet formulas is one of the biggest things that I use it personally for. You write down exactly what you want and you'll find someone with a formula that's doing that already. I'm trying to like something about combining. What one I was doing the other day was trying to match up multiple columns of data and then outputting a value based on that. So you're essentially doing a VLOOKUP or trying to find one column, but then you're doubling that up and trying to also match a second column. By being super specific with something like matching two columns in Google Sheets and then returning another value based on those values, you'd be able to find something that someone's already done that or multiple versions of it and be able to piece together your own little solution.
Yeah, great. Just basically doing what Google does, finding information.
Exactly. And people are hating on it, but it's so useful sometimes.
I mean, but that's just it. When you strip everything back, I think a lot of SEOs are so wrapped up in the data and the tools and everything. They basically get a URL, slap it in a tool, and basically just go through whatever the tool says. I think a lot of this mindset and a lot of this, well, strip it right back and understand what's important and how the journey starts, going through the journey.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely.
You know. So, as you said, you've been in the industry for how long?
2005 is when I first did my first website or my first one of those free web things on a subdomain. So, yeah, been a little while.
Right. So, from then to now, how have you seen the industry change? What sort of things have changed during that time?
Well, my least favorite change was being able to use Scrapebox and a software that BMD, Bookmarking Daemon, was my favorite one. You literally could enter a keyword and press go and you could rank number one the next day. It was amazing. And so that's the biggest change. But, I mean, that was still back in 2012, 2013, that Panda and Penguin rolled out. That hurt me bad. That hurt my first real business. I'd like to say I went from hero to zero pretty quick with that one. But that was the main change. And since then, there's all been the little tweaks, but they certainly got so much smaller as time goes on. The core of it has been content. It's been content since 2013, good content. You can game it. There's always little bits of things you can game, like Kyle with the lorem ipsum issue, if you saw that, where he was able to rank, I think, number one for a pretty competitive type thing with lorem ipsum content. There's still ways to kind of trick Google, as there always will be, as it changes and makes one thing more valuable, something else gets tweaked, which then might create a hole. The same hole that was available 10 years ago might come up again. But it still just comes down to having that good content. And then on top of that, though, the next biggest thing is just more people doing it. There's more people in the SEO mindset. It's not just a mum and dad blogger anymore that you're competing against. It could be an SEO on the other side of the world trying to rank in a market that they've never landed, like set foot in, that you're competing with now.
Affiliate marketing.
Exactly. The joys of it.
Yeah. There's quite a few SEOs have affiliate marketing as a side gig.
Yeah.
But you mentioned a couple of times gaming the market.
Yeah.
Now, instead of thinking gaming the market, shouldn't you just do things right to start with? Instead of trying to think, well, how can I make Google think this? Instead of, well, what can I do to get Google to know we're thinking this?
So the way I see SEO and gamification is a bit like you want to push the boundaries sometimes. You need to be able to test things out. You want to find the limit of what you can safely do before it becomes unsafe, so that you can do your best work essentially within safe bounds. And so there are a couple of ways I kind of approach it. Firstly, client work, I never do dodgy stuff. It's always above board. You get a bit of a free pass with client work and programmatic builds on the back of an existing business because they've got a valuable business. They've got their own content. It's just about restructuring and reorganizing that content to get the value. You don't really need to gain much to get easy wins. But side projects where you're going up against people that are already gaming the system, you sometimes want to push the boundaries to be able to test what you can safely do. So whilst, yes, you try and keep it above board, you also, the way I see it is you also want to kind of push it to the limits a bit and see what you can kind of get away with on potentially money sites, but mostly for me, it'll be your non-money sites that you kind of play around with to know what you can do with your money sites.
Yeah, I mean, over the years, I've probably tested everything, or at least most things, but it's been on my own sites or a site I've just built to test things. So that way, there's no real impact.
Definitely.
To see what works, what doesn't. When you've been traveling around, obviously you've met other SEOs. Do you have like a group of do you ever gather do a meetup in an area of SEOs and just chat about, well, the industry, what's going on, how they're finding things, an SEO nomad meetup type of thing?
Yeah, so Thailand, Chiang Mai in Thailand probably has the highest density of SEOs anywhere in the world. And they have a weekly or monthly meetup there. So I met a couple of them when I was there. But then leaving there, you don't come across SEOs too often, surprisingly. There's a lot of digital people, a lot of people with digital work, but SEOs are really few and far between. So more so than an SEO meetup, you go and meet people at a digital nomad meetup, where then you meet a couple of SEOs and you talk about it there. I more so just have a small group of SEO mates from, well, at one point we were in each of us were in a different country, but now most of them are back in Australia and I'm pretty much the only one out of the country now. And then that's where I kind of chit-chat my SEO and get that SEO nerd fix, I guess. And then various Slack groups would be the other point. It's not every day that you kind of chit-chatting to an SEO in one of these sort of co-working because everyone's different. There's content writers sometimes, but then there's a lot of developers that are around the place. But then, yeah, people with other jobs like product marketers and product managers and just completely somewhat unrelated to SEO but still digital work.
Yeah. So are there any, big SEO nomad online groups that people could join if they're thinking of doing it or they are out there?
Yeah, so the big SEO Slack group or the Reddit /big SEO is one of the ones I'm in. I think it's got about 8,000 people that have joined, of which probably a couple hundred are properly active in it. So that'll be worth jumping in. If you go on Reddit for big SEO, you'll be able to find the join link. And then you'll be able to get accepted into that at some point. And then there's a couple other groups that are starting to pop up now, but that's kind of the main one where you can get a variety of SEO people in there, from super beginners, the people that have never touched SEO, to people like myself answering questions and a few other experienced SEOs jumping in when needed.
All right. So if you was to start this travel journey again, would there be anything you'd do different, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, so, I mean, the biggest thing for me is when I quit my job in Melbourne to go overseas, I had no side hustle essentially going. I'd had little things kind of kicked off over the years, but because I was working full-time for 4.5-5 years, I just really hadn't put a proper effort into the side work. I guess knowing what I know now, then I would have put a bit more effort in the month or 2 months of the lead-up to be able to go overseas with something kind of going. I didn't really start anything until I got back overseas. And so I would have warmed something up, got some projects going, had some, got some domains and sites warmed up with just a few pieces of content that I could sit there for a year or 2 years. I'm only finally doing that now in the last year or so, where I've started to get a heap of different websites going that I can kind of sit there. If something happens, cool. If nothing happens, they can just kind of sit there. They cost you, what, $10 a year in the domain. So, yeah.
Yeah. So as far as sustaining a life, obviously there is survival and there's actually making it worthwhile doing it.
Yep.
Anyone thinking of basically just working the way around, what would you say is the minimum sort of monthly? So you can never guarantee, but guaranteed income you should think about before you start the journey.
Well, I mean, the monthly minimum would also depend on what savings you'd be willing to burn. So, I mean, for me, I had a chunk of savings that I was willing to kind of go through, and that got me kicked off, whereas others might not have it, and then, yeah, you might want the monthly. But in terms of monthly costs that you'd want to be able to cover, especially in Thailand, you'll find a lot of YouTube videos about living on $500 a month. By all means, you'd be scraping past, and I wouldn't be recommending that. But in terms of US dollars, I'd say $1,500 to $2,000 a month would let you live a solid life in majority of non-Australia, UK, US, et cetera, type countries. Like particularly South America, $2,000 US would do you really well. And same with Asia. You can probably drop $500 and do $1,500 and still be okay out in Asia.
Yeah, I ask because I have noticed on a few occasions people say, oh, well, you know, I've got this beautiful pad, you know, I'm at the side of the ocean, it's gorgeous, and I pay next to nothing for it. And I think this sort of perception, that's what people have in their head and not sort of reality when you get to a place.
Well, when I was in Asia before COVID, some of the hotels were $20, $25 Australian a night, booked the night before per night type thing. And so you can find some really, really nice places for under $30 Australian. You won't find that in Australia. You won't find that in the US. Going to some of the islands off Bali, you can get a beachside resort for $30 a night. And so, yeah, you can get some really, really good value in places. You just sometimes also have to get lucky in terms of timing. You have to know where you're going beforehand. Some of the places you'll book online and they've got the prettiest photo ever, you rock up and there's cockroaches, the photos were taken 20 years ago, the beach might be nothing like what's shown. Instead of beachside, it's actually three streets back from the beach, etc. So yeah,
we can say that about most countries when booking a hotel.
Definitely.
I was going to say. Yeah, but I'm just thinking of people that want to make the step. Yep. What sort of mindset, what sort of things do they have to be okay with? You know, what about, you know, thinking about health care? You know, thinking about, well, what happens if I get ill, or what happens when you live in such a life where it's more or less day to day? You know, what other things do you have to think about regarding that?
Yeah, definitely. Well, health to me wasn't a big concern because where I am normally, the healthcare isn't too expensive. Like in Chiang Mai, they have a big water festival where you basically just get water guns and thousands of people are throwing buckets of filthy moat water on top of each other. And one of the big things that everyone gets is ear infections because of the dirty water. And so I got an ear infection. Going to see a doctor, getting some antibiotics, the whole thing cost me about $30 Australian after seeing them twice. So that wasn't a massive thing, but then you can also get Nomad insurance with a mob called Safety Wing, and that's about 30 or 40 Australian a month, and that will cover a lot of stuff. And so being in Asia during COVID, they actually covered an evacuation flight to Australia for me that was about $2,000. And so me paying $30 a month, I got a free flight home, which was a pretty good little setup there and a good little investment. That wasn't a big one there. But one of the big things to think about is you'll meet people that all want to party every night, that aren't working, that are out traveling the world for 3 to 6 months. If you're working, that isn't a lifestyle that you can maintain. You will get sidetracked. You will lose focus. It's not something you can just kind of go out and do every night because it will bite you. It will come back to bite you bad.
I think that's the differentiator, isn't it? Because it's that mindset. Well, you're not on holiday. You're just working somewhere different.
Exactly.
It's about having structure, I suppose, in your life.
Exactly. Keeping that, I wouldn't say 9 to 5, but keeping somewhat, this is when you're working. This is when you go out for dinner and a drink, or this is like, it gives you the freedom though, that you could take Wednesday off and just go off and do a day activity. That's fine. But then you have to know that you still got to kind of come back to it, and you still got to do work Thursday and Friday. You can move your schedule around, but you still need to lock in X hours of work a week somehow.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to say we've covered so much there. It's mind-blowing. The reason I wanted to invite you on is because in my 20s, quite a few years ago now, I did set off wanting to travel the world. Only got as far as Greece. I was there for 4 years. So then got back and, well, I never got out again. So it's kind of personal thing. Like, well, if I was younger, I'd probably be doing it. And so listening to genuine stories about what it's really like from somebody that's doing it, is for anyone else thinking about doing this and not just believing. That's the thing I wanted to say. Well, these are the things you need to think about. And it's not just believe someone to say, oh, you know, it's easy. You can do this. You can do that thing with the internet. You know, it's obviously a major thing. But if you, knowing what you know now, could change one thing in the industry for the better, what would it be?
I'd remove Panda and Penguin from the algorithm and let me have my fun back.
That's. I know we can work some miracles, but I think that's going beyond it. In fact, I remember the very day is I were actually sat in my car outside the supermarket because I hate shopping, and I were literally on my phone. Saw the update and I was thinking, I need to get home now. And I remember it was on a Sunday afternoon or something that I need to get home now. It's been amazing. Final question. Is there anything anybody can do watching this or listening to this? Is there anything they can do to help you with anything?
I mean, read my blog posts, and I'd love any feedback there. I'd love to know whether what I'm talking about makes sense most of the time, and whether it's something people know already, or whether it's something people are interested in, whether they know a little bit about programmatic, or whether they know nothing about programmatic and want to learn. That's what I'd really like to know.
And where can they find your blog?
On sammyseo.com, sammyseo.com.
Brilliant. And do you chat much on social if anybody wants to connect?
So recently a lot of LinkedIn. So you can definitely find me as Sam Partland on LinkedIn. And then I've just started Twitter. So, I mean, I created the account over 10 years ago, but I'm finally actually starting to use it, which is I should have done it a few years ago.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I've had a blast. I mean, we could go on forever, but, you know, we both have work to do. And it, like you say, it's not a constant party. But thank you again. And it's been amazing. And I've actually, it's made me think about a few things, not about jumping ship and leaving the kids at all, but, you know, on just different mindsets with what you shared about the programmatic.
I'm glad that could be helpful.
So that's it. Well, Sam, thanks a lot.
Not a problem.
And keep me updated where you get to.
You've been listening to the Unscripted SEO Interview Podcast with me, Mark A. Preston. Join us next time as I interview more top SEO professionals.